Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This week's Geriatric Journal Club is a joint presentation of the Florida Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.
All right. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining. I am really happy to be hosting another Journal Club prior to our Best Care Practice Conference that's going to be in a few weeks. Usually in October, we don't do a Journal Club because of how things overlap. So this is kind of nice. And I wanted to do some things just a little bit differently. So you're going to see our agenda, which is a discussion as we always start with our state of the state. I wanted to go through some updates and guidance that has recently been made available, as well as some recommendations from the CMS Commission. And then I would like to do just an open discussion around our journeys to date, how we've been dealing with going through this pandemic. And I hope that by the time we get to that point, we'll have people who are willing to share. If not, I might call on you. So if we can go ahead and advance to the next slide. I don't think anyone is unaware of where we're at as a nation, over 7.5 million cases, and our global deaths, for the United States, here is reporting 210,000 plus deaths. I think the latest number I saw from the Worldometer was around 212,000 plus deaths. So we are still in it. And if you have been brave enough to look at the news, you'll see that there have been more outbreaks, and we're seeing in some states, especially in the Midwest, where we're seeing rising numbers. So we're seeing climbing numbers in New York, and I anticipate that we may start seeing some changing numbers in Florida as well, given that we are now truly reopened in phase three reopenings with schools set to go back in the county that I'm at on Friday. So, you know, there's a lot of things to be aware of. There are still a lot of places where we do not see masking. And so this climate is a little worrisome. And of course, as we talked about on our previous call, we're also in the flu season. So we're hoping that we're going to see more people get vaccinated, but you know, we're at the beginning of flu. We've already ran into a little bit of problems with some of our facilities, but the good thing is that we are seeing people who have an interest in getting their flu shot. So if we advance to the next slide, you know, this is for the United States. This is from the Johns Hopkins Resource Center. And it just shows where we were at in April of 2020, how elevated we were as far as the percentage positive. And now that we're doing more daily total tests, you know, we're about, for the United States, at 5.05% positivity rate, which is not bad. It still means that we have an abundance of people testing positive, and I think our daily case yesterday was around 43,000. I think maybe a little over 43,000. So we still see that we are at a higher rate as far as where we would want to be at the state of reopening that we are at. If you advance to the next slide, now, this is the breakdown. Again, this is from the Johns Hopkins resource pages as well. And this is a breakdown of what's happening with at the state level. So this graphic, I think we've shown it several times before. It is showing that for Florida, you know, we're still in that higher than 5% positivity rate. And our positivity rate as of this morning was 10.84%. Now that varies from county to county. And if you're outside the state of Florida, you could probably appreciate that too. County to county, everyone's trending on with their own numbers. So I know in South Florida, we've seen that there has been, a reduction in the positivity rate. So that was why we were able to move forward. I don't know what's going to happen, given that we've been in this 2-week period of opening, and we'll see what happens once the schools open. But we, as a whole, for the state of Florida, we've been doing better than we have in the past few months. If we advance to the next slide, this is our total cases for Florida. We're over 700,000 plus, and we've been over that number for a while, with these latest numbers being reported at 11 a.m. We still see that we have some hot spots, which are in the Tampa area, Orlando, and of course, South Florida as a whole remains where we're getting the majority of our cases. If we go to the next slide, just wanted to share with you some different level of information that we're now getting from the Department of Health. So they are looking at tracking influenza-like illness versus COVID-like illness. And I know for the entity that I work for, we've been doing these type of trackings as well, and really looking at flu cast like our flu predictions as versus our COVID predictions for the upcoming months. So we can see that we are where we're still seeing more COVID-like illness, and that is what they classify it at until we get a diagnosis. As of Monday, as far as new cases in the state of Florida, we had about 2,500. So, like I said, doing better than where we had been, but our positivity rate still remains a little bit higher than what it should be. If you go to the next slide, this is for the nursing facility. So where we're at in looking at our ALs and our SNFs, our positivity rate through October 7th is about 0.77%. And for staff is 1.37%. So as a whole, I think, and I don't know unless you guys have seen something different throughout the state, I think we're doing better when it comes to testing and getting in front of cases. A lot of our facilities have resources available to them if they cannot keep a COVID-19 patient in place, and many more now have dedicated units. Where I think, if you go to the next slide, where I think that we are at and trying to figure out what comes next. As we mentioned and talked about a little on our last call, we're in the flu season. We're at the beginning. There have been guidance and recommendations that have come out, some controversial, some not so much. But I wanted to run through a couple of things with you. So the first update, if you advance, came out this week, and it was around the FDA's emergency use authorization guidance, a guidance document. And why I think this was very significant is because there's been a lot of concerns given the mixed messages about the vaccination plan. I think there was information given like 2 or 3 weeks ago to the various state departments of health to be ready and have a plan for implementing and distributing vaccines by November. And Operation Warp Speed is still occurring, which is the operation to develop a vaccination. And we know that there are companies who are in phase 3 trials. So with what the FDA decided to do is to make sure that we are comfortable with what we're seeing, they put out this guidance document, and the big takeaway is that for any volunteers who are in the trials and receiving the vaccine, the companies have to wait till 2 months after that last volunteer receives the vaccine to monitor for side effects before they could come and ask for emergency use authorization. So I think this is one of those situations where it is being from what we saw AMDA put out with their recommendations around vaccinations and what we're seeing as a whole. I think this is well received across our community. And I know on our AMDA state task force, this was something that moved around and was circulated quite strongly. The next thing that I wanted to show you guys was the COVID-19 considerations, strategies, and resources for crisis standards of care in post-acute and long-term care facilities. So this is something that a work group that was formed and several of us from FAMDA and many more people from other AMDA chapters were involved in writing this up. And it was really just to look at how do we stay prepared? How do we develop guidance around monitoring whatever stage we are at within an epidemic or a pandemic. And it is a long document, but I wanted to show you one example of what you could find in this. If you go to the next page for me, Shane. So this is a sample of the continuum of care. And this is when our facilities are thinking about operationalizing their plans and the delivery of care and management. So, you know, what we were able to do is really get them to think about what they need to do in three different buckets. So conventional, what you're normally used to. Contingency, if we need to operationalize an emergency preparedness plan, where we need to be, and then the crisis, anytime there's an epidemic or a pandemic. So this is just one sample, one very small graphic in a very long document, but it goes through things to think about depending on where your facility is at in time. So it came out a lot later than we were hoping for, but it is something that I think will be a tool, a guidance tool for facilities to help develop their emergency preparedness plans. What I think many of you may have seen in the last couple of weeks is the final report from the CMS Commission, and that's where I want to spend some time at. If you advance to the next slide for me. So I showed this graphic when we were talking to our last guest speaker about the next wave. And it was really the framework for what the CMS Commission put forth. Now, there has been some controversy around the CMS Commission recommendations, questions of omission of information versus just changing information. So when we were discussing this, there were some concerns because some people wouldn't sign off on it. Nonetheless, I think in looking through it all, it is a good resource, and they do have some interesting action steps that they recommended. So if we go to the next page, the key takeaways that they really wanted to hit upon was how to make sure residents and families connect, how to keep the staff safe, and the overall management of the nursing home so that we could effectively assure that we are doing all the emergency measures, reporting things as we need to, and getting access to any needed help and resources. And they also looked at, you know, the limitations and issues around CMS identifying funding needs and where we need to implement long-standing changes for long-term care. Now, I will say, I think when I looked through this document, and it's maybe 160 pages, maybe more, there were not enough mentions about the role of the medical director, in my opinion, and the role of the clinical teams. But I think there are things that we could build upon. They were able to give us the principal recommendations. So I wanted to go through those because it's 9 themes with about 27 recommendations. So when we looked at their first, the first thing that they focused in on, and it was securing testing and screening capabilities. It is interesting that, you know, they looked at everything that the federal, the state, local, territorial, and tribal partners can implement. One of the recommendations, the main recommendations, is coordination with your partners to make sure that you have the ability to get those tests in place. And we saw this really being put into action with the rapid testing that was initiated, the point of care testing. However, the issues around that not being ignored, it is still the tool that was made available to the nursing facilities. There's also the increase in PPE supply and use, and the recommendations that you have to work collaboratively with the federal, state, local, territorial, tribal partners to assure that those nursing facilities have a way to get more PPE in place. So I think this is, once again, something that we've discussed many times, but this recommendation also includes guidance and action steps. If you go in, that really talks about how to network and advocate a resource with those different entities so that you can get and maintain a maintain the PPE in your facility. Something that I don't think that I thought was really great that the CDC put out, when they put out the information about donning and doffing, was also how to utilize those tools to look at the burn rate. How often are we going through information? And when we had leading agent Morris Life present, they talked about how they were able to create a system where they knew how often that mask was being used and when it needed to be retired and get a new mask, and how clean the non-disposable gowns, how often they were cleaning in the process. So that goes under that. When we're rethinking cohorting practices, you know, this I think is something that we're going to have to really still evolve and looking at what are the best methodologies for infection prevention and control. How do we balance the resident and staff safety and psychological health with our infection prevention and control? There needs to be an evolution. I think in all the guest speakers that we've had so far to date, I still haven't heard what A-plus solution would be, like where we need to go. But I think the fact that we're thinking through it and looking at some articles, you know, in particular, I think we have one, Calming the Perfect Storm, that we really need to think thoroughly and in depth about the infrastructure that we need for post-acute long-term care so that we can be flexible when we're thinking about how we cohort and what we need to do. And we need to, I appreciated that they really just discussed how to address the differences in nursing homes. As we know that there are many challenges, some nursing homes can, easily able to open up a COVID unit, and others are have still not, especially within this state where we have so many nursing facilities. I heard recently we had a guest from North Dakota on one of the task force meetings, and they talked about the fact that now that they're seeing a surge, their facilities cannot accommodate the cases, and they were not prepared. Although we had all this information, they were not prepared as a state to cohort all of their residents in the facility. So it was interesting to listen to what the challenges other states are having. And then the fourth theme was around prioritizing visitation activities. Multiple recommendations along these lines. And I think, you know, still some things that we need to really consider and think about, because we are, you know, we came into disagreement with what our state, the state of Florida, was doing with reopening. I felt that I think I expressed my opinion that it felt overly complicated. But then we saw that CMS came out with similar guidance, not to the point of redefining the different types of visitors, but similar guidance. And we do know that a lot of facilities had already implemented compassionate care visitations and rules around that. So in this, there is a lot of information to unpack. I think that the one thing is we do have to consider the mental health and psychosocial well-being of our residents, and figure out better virtual visit tools and techniques if ever you have a facility that has to go back into lockdown, because we don't want to bring in those cases of COVID. We want to make sure the residents and the staff are safe. We've seen some very detrimental outbreaks in facilities in this time of pandemic, where the medical staff is out, the nursing staff is cut in half, and the building is like 50% positivity with COVID cases. So there's been a lot of dramatic cases like that, and we really need to think about how we do this safely so that we can avoid any of those future outbreaks that we're anticipating. If you go to the next slide, and I think there was a question, so I'm trying to acknowledge. There was a question, I think, or a comment about ALF settings. An emergency order requires shut down visitors for positive staff tests, 14-day quarantine, and for return of key staff members. They will continue to test positive without symptoms. So I think in that question, you know, it is really like, what is our opinion about how we should be testing in the ALF setting? I think the guidance that we've had and where we've been at is we should be following a similar guidance for our SNFs as far as testing and doing visitation. So if we have a staff who is positive, and we need to really follow those CDC guidelines as far as when they can come back. If they're out of quarantine and they tested negative, you know, we can bring them back differently than if they had not had a positive test, and if we were just testing them based off of symptoms. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I would say follow the CDC. If they are no symptoms and they test negative, then they can, there is guidance about keeping them out for 10 days and making sure that we are following the CDC guidelines. As far as the next recommendation about supporting nursing home communication with residents and families, I think this is, pretty well understood that we need to make sure we have good communication back and forth. And then I think where there were the majority of the recommendations came around strengthening the workforce ecosystem, making sure that we are supportive of staff needs as far as hazard pay, surge support options, you know, how do we have a plan together if we need to bring in different CNAs, if we need to train up people to get them to help with any surges that we're seeing. The benefit of a certified infection preventionist, I think now we're in that age where that is not just something that's going to need to be done off the side of someone's desk. I think we're going to need to make sure we are really looking at the resources that we have available, because we need to have someone who is committed to that role. And I say that just from my experience. I'm not sure if in certain facilities they have a full-time infection preventionist, but in my experience, it was usually the ADON who would be assigned that work, and it was on top of his or her other work. So We really need to start looking at the way we are doing business in the facility.
Managing your patient's needs across multiple specialties is increasingly important, but also an increasingly challenging task. U.S. Post Acute Care now offers clinical staffing solutions not only for primary care medicine, but also for behavioral health, chronic care management, and telehealth, bringing you a more comprehensive solution for your patients and your facilities. Now more than ever, your patients need you in so many ways. Let U.S. Post Acute Care help you deliver more complete, quality care. For more information, visit us at uspostacutecare.com.
If we go to the next slide, so catalyzing technical assistance and quality improvement, I don't think anyone would disagree with that. We need to really reprioritize our activities, look at the support structure, the infrastructure that the facilities have in place, and what we can do, because we saw every issue that our facilities have always had as far as transferring data, receiving data, utilizing tech has been exacerbated during this pandemic. So we really need to think about how we are improving our facilities. And then looking at how we are enhancing facility design. There was something that I believe was mentioned in an article that Dr. Auslander published, Calming the Perfect Storm, about redesigning our nursing homes so that there is a different model, maybe the greenhouse model, some models that we've seen implemented throughout the world that may be different for maybe better suited to deal with pandemic related issues and crises. And then I like that they included making data more actionable. We really do need to be able to improve the way we, like I said before, retrieve data, collect data, and send it off. Identifying those particular problems that we had in getting our data back out to CMS and getting our data to the state and getting information in. That bi-directional need for our data. It is something that I don't think many of our facilities have been able to keep up with. I don't know if we still have a good plan and in place to move our facilities along. You know, some facilities are going to go faster, but I'm thinking about a handful of facilities that are nowhere near ready for these things and have really suffered during this pandemic. So I wanted to just go through some of that. They have even more if we go forward. I think this may be the last of those slides, but they have even more recommendations in the overall document where they are just giving us the best care recommendations. And I think for what we need to do, whether you are a part of this organization or other organizations, is really start looking at how do we put these things in action. The action steps that they have are great. I do agree with colleagues who said that they don't go as far as we need them to go, but I think it's really on us now to take these and make them into living recommendations that we could actually put it to practice. And as I was going through this document, it really made me think about where we are at and where we've been and where we're going. And the one thing that I think that we've not done yet in this setting, in this forum, is really just hear from everyone or anyone about the journey that they're having through this pandemic. I say that because this is October. For me, this is a month of reflection, not only because I had a birthday, but it's also the month that we have our best care practice conference. And for me, that's always been the time where I sit through and get a moment to reflect and look at, am I on mission? And only because we have some people who will ask you questions like Dr. Pandia, who will ask you those kind of questions, like, what are you doing? How are you doing? And how is it going? So for me, it's always been this real moment of reflection. And in 2013, when I lost my mom, in the month of October, it became even more so, where I now sit down a week before our event and ask myself those questions. Am I on the track that I want to be on? And as I was doing that this month, over this past weekend, I realized, you know, we really haven't shared our stories in a very non-formal way, and we sort of don't have that ability because of those moments that you would get at a conference with all of this turning virtual. Those are lost, of those little conversations you may have going to get coffee or sitting waiting for our next session to start. We don't have that time. So I wanted to save some time and really think about what have we been going through as far as clinicians, medical directors, whether you are in a corporate role like I am, or you're out in front of a nursing home and doing virtual QAs, just really thinking about where we're at. And, you know, I've had the benefit of being able to look at what's happening and moving through data and talking and having these conversations with a lot of different people from across the country, bringing them onto our journal clubs and really talking to them. I realize that I've not really shared as much as I probably normally would in one of these kind of settings. And I wanted to start this part of our session by really talking about my personal journey through this. As I mentioned before, I'm in the corporate role. I work for United Healthcare, and I've worked for them for many years in other roles. So when, you know, this happened, I wasn't actively in a facility, a nursing home, where I was a medical director. And it was really difficult to not have that role. I left that role when I left my Optum medical directorship, which is part of United Healthcare, but moving to a national role, there's a different level of responsibility, and I knew I couldn't do that medical directorship of that nursing home any longer. So not being able to get out in front of this, as I saw things start to happen in February and following the news even back in January, like something, you know, getting a little worried and then seeing what happened in Washington, I was like, okay, you know, I have to figure out a way to work and to help and to talk to the facilities and talk to the director of nurses who are out there and doing this work, and the CMOs that I know who are out in the buildings. And it wasn't that easy. It was actually quite difficult outside of this forum to talk to people because we were all on high alert. And I then made a promise to my family that I wouldn't go back out into the field because they were asking for volunteers. And that was really difficult to sit down with my husband and my kids who said, asking and saying, please don't volunteer. And I'm like, that's against everything that I know because I wanted to be out there in the front. The one thing that has been, you know, sort of that has pushed me out into a front line is that when I transitioned to different roles, not only did I give up medical directorships, I closed down my practice that was being ran by other work by other clinicians. And we had a group of patients who were in ALFs and who were being seen at home, who were not easily transferred to another primary care, whether it was because they'd been with my practice for so long, or they were home and frail and being treated at home, and we couldn't find a clinician to take over their care. So there's a few people who I kept on, and, you know, not enough to make a living from, but just a few people who I was able to keep under my own personal care. And as this was all unfolding, trying to figure out what they were going to need in their environments, talking to the CMO who's over there, the assisted living facility that I have a few people at, it was like you were seeing, okay, there are some major challenges. I wanted to just share with you a couple. One was when we were when the rules came out that we could do telehealth in any capacity and get out there and talk to our patients, you know, I was like, okay, I'm going to do telehealth on all those people who I still see in their home environment and talk to them about what they're going through. Figure out what they need, do the assessment as well as I can over the phone, via FaceTime. And for those who couldn't use FaceTime, just try to get something so that I could get some information. And we had a patient, I had a patient who was a 76-year-old male. And I remember it was a Friday night where I got a call from his son who said, I can't get in touch with my dad. I haven't been able to get in touch with him all day. And I said, sure, I'll call him. He and I were supposed to speak earlier, but he didn't answer the phone. So sure enough, I finally got him on the phone at around 7 p.m. on a Friday night. And in talking to him, I could tell that there was something wrong with his mentation. He was not at baseline. He needed to go to the ER, and he was able to, ironically, do a face-to-face visit through FaceTime. And I'm like, I guess the fact that he had done this several times with his kids and his grandkids made it easy for him to do that. And we were talking, and you know, I'm trying to do this assessment with him, and he collapsed right in front of me while on the phone, bringing him and his phone down to the floor. And he stopped responding, where he was not saying anything. I couldn't, I'm yelling on the phone and I couldn't get to him. At that time, I start texting his son, who was texting the neighbor to see if the neighbor would just go to the door. And I text the son that I'm calling 911. And calling 911 from my home to somebody else on the other side home is not the easiest thing in the world. You get patched to whatever city they're in, and at least here in Broward County. And it took a couple of tries to get somebody to understand that I was calling for paramedics to go to this gentleman's home. And this was in April. So this is when everyone still did not have enough PPE, and it was very hard to get people to respond and get people to even do a well check because they were out of supplies. So we were able I was able to convince the police that I needed the paramedics to go out right away. The neighbor agreed to open the door, but she wouldn't go into the home. And when they found him, he was in respiratory distress on the floor, requiring emergent treatment, and was transferred to the hospital. From there, you know, he went into the hospital. His first COVID test was negative. And by that Monday, he was out to a SNF because they said, well, you know, this may just be a new baseline. They did not CT him. They didn't do any of that. They sent him to a SNF. Fortunately, this SNF had the ability to test him, and he came back positive 48 hours later and back in the hospital. About a week now has passed, and he's in the hospital, not seeing a physician at the hospital because everything is via telehealth. But, you know, still, it was very difficult for anyone to just get in there because of the issues. The nurses were doing a lot of the communication back and forth with the family, and the family received a message that stated, oh, well, he needs to be on hospice. But no one was there to talk to them. They had to wait till 9 p.m. that night to talk to a hospice nurse. They still hadn't communicated with any physician. So I found myself being brought into the situation to communicate with whoever the attending doctor was about where we were at and get the family to consent to being on hospice. And the whole experience was very surreal, very emotional. I think the night that I had to get him to the ER, I stayed awake all night crying, because when you make those type of connections with people and you're in their home and you may only have a dozen patients, they're they become more than a patient. They become part of your family. And in dealing with that, then it brings me into a second story where I had this woman who was part of a group home, a United Cerebral Palsy group home. And there was, across Broward County and I believe Dade County, a massive outbreak within these group homes. Many of the staff were COVID positive, but they were still coming into work because there was nobody else to come into work. Many of those residents in those group homes were COVID positive. And for this one lady, this young lady who I always called young, she was 73. She was one of those people who we were very happy to keep in her group home because we thought she was going to have to be transferred to a SNF. And it was difficult for the managers of that group home to part ways with her because they had been taking care of her for so long. So we made a care plan where she could stay in her group home despite having a peg tube in place and despite needing certain other services. We were able to coordinate that with the home health company and the group home to make a care plan that was uniquely personalized for her. She went out the day before one of our journal clubs, went to the hospital with a complaint of abdominal pain. And I spoke to the attending physician and as well as the palliative care doc. I spoke to the palliative care doc because when they did a CT of her abdomen, they saw ground glass opacities in the bottom of her lungs. So they ended up doing a CT of her lungs as well as a COVID 19 test for which she tested positive for. I'll never forget, we were on journal club, but it was a very enlightening and very informative journal club that we were on. And as I got off that call and looked at my phone, I realized I had missed two calls. It was from that palliative care physician who informed me that this patient had passed away. She was fine when we talked that morning at around 9 a.m. But by noon, she had gone into respiratory distress and subsequently passed away. She didn't go through a code because we were able to keep her DNR in place. And after finding that out, we found out about the conclusion for the gentleman who went through, who was the telehealth 911 emergency, who had also passed away, fortunately, on hospice. And it was probably one of the worst days that I've had during the pandemic because I was not able to really talk or share that with. I didn't know who to talk to, about what I was experiencing. And then what brought it all home was the next day. I get a call from my aunt who said her husband had, my uncle, had gone to the ER twice and was turned away because he didn't have a fever. He was short of breath. He was having abdominal pain, but he didn't have a fever and none of his vitals seemed worrisome enough to where he needed to be tested for COVID or screened in the hospital. So even though he had CHF and COPD, and even though, and I always joke about the county that we live in, everybody could get admitted for chest pain, whether they're 20 or 85 or 105, you hear chest pain in the ER, they're going to get admitted, except for in this situation. So he would sit back home, not one time, but two times within the same week. And in dealing with the patient issue, you get a call that now this uncle is gone. He went to sleep and she went to check on him and he wasn't breathing. And trying to deal with all of that, I don't know. There weren't enough apps in the world for mindfulness. There weren't enough people to talk to get through with that. And I put that story as a dealing with disparity because I don't know what made him so different that they did listen to him. All I do know is now, after several family members with similar stories, some who were tested and some who could never get a test, have passed away. It is, I will say, at this moment of time where I'm doing a big reflection, it has been really challenging moving forward through this pandemic. And I'm going to stop there and see if anyone else wants to share what they...
Hey, Diane, this is Greg. I'm glad to share a little bit if you like. I'd be glad to let anybody else go if they want, because as you know, we worked together for a while at United before your promotion. Anybody else? Don't want you to think this. Go ahead, Brian, you first.
Yeah. No, I was just going to thanks Dr. Sanders for sharing that journey. And I think we all just have to realize that there have been a lot of losses this year. And so I think it's something that we have to understand about ourselves and others, and our, whether it's our patients and our employees and our coworkers. And I think that's probably been the one piece of this journey that, you know, now that we're past 6 months into it, and you think you might see the finish line, but every time I think I get a glimpse of it, it's gone. So I think, you know, your stories are right. And just when you think you are getting in a cadence with it, that something changes, a recommendation changes, visitation starts again. And I kind of had the opposite thing that happened to you, in the sense of I had just changed positions into a more corporate level thing, where I thought I was going to be getting able to do more strategic and other type things. But within months, the pandemic hit, and I was back into the nitty gritty, into the detail that I, you know, I guess was made for, but had not thought that's where I would be. And so the last 6 months have been, back, you're right, sleeves rolled up in the facilities, and going through, the daily grinds of what everybody goes through. And so I think you're right. I just wanted to, you know, make sure you're right. And just the different pieces, we don't realize, we just have to stop. I was at one of the facilities yesterday, St. John's, and just looking at the staff, there was going to be an in-service for influenza from the DON, and she had 30 nurses there at 3:30. And I said, do you mind if I say a few words? And so I went in there and I started with, thank you. Thank you for everything and, that you guys are doing and where you are. And I tried to, I'm looking at them all masked up and face shields, and I'm thinking, I have trouble doing that for the 4 hours I'm in the building, and they're doing it all day, every day, with the fears and a level that I just said, oh my gosh. So I guess I just wanted to share just, you're right, the realities of where we are. And I like what you were saying, Dr. Sanders, about personal reflection and, how do you help and move forward? And I guess sometimes, and then the other thing is, we just have to be ready to ask for help from each other too, and call, and what would you do on this? I've luckily found a few of those people, and, would reach out to any of you if I thought, but it was luckily to be able to say, I'm not sure, I need to check on that, because everybody's looking at you. What do you want to do right now, this second? And sometimes you can have a few, I usually say, let me process that and call you with that, because I'm going to phone a friend, because I'm not ready, there's so many gray areas and things too that are still, and there's conflicting guidances. CMS is guidance for ACA's guidance for visitation is conflicting, and what do you do? And we're just seeing our first round of lawsuits starting to come in, that mom died with COVID, in your facility, and so that's going to be the next round, and the stress on the industry, and so we were lucky, we've only had can count on one or two hands the, you know, but it's, you know, it's, that's coming, you know? And so I have a meeting with Leading Age later today about, you know, what does that mean for Florida? So just wanted to tell you, thank you. And we're all, I think, going through, and then you're right. Life happens while you're doing all this. And, you know, my father passed away a couple months ago, you know, and I, you know, luckily the pandemic was a little bit lighter than, and I could get back there, but I can only imagine people who couldn't and be, you know, the, how do you grieve? And, you know, we had a funeral with seven people, and my dad was a high school gym teacher in a small town where the whole town would have showed up, you know? So all these little things eat at, you know, we all have our little lives going on, but think about our staff and the people we're working with. So it's just, you know, those pieces. So I think thanks for bringing humanity back to this, Dr. Sanders. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And thank you, Dr. Kay. Thank you, Dr. James. I think, I know it's not easy to share, but in order for us to really think about how we want to bring life to whatever recommendations and all the guidance and what is real, I think we want to hear your story. So if you don't feel comfortable sharing in this forum, please send us emails about your clinical narrative and what you've been experiencing. Because I am thinking about how to advocate for our needs, I think we're going to have to really bring back, as you said, Dr. K, the humanity piece. Make people understand what we're seeing when we are treating people that try to write policy for patients in a very long lasting pandemic. That, you know, I think that before we got on this call, the emergency order was extended till January 2021, and I'm sure it will go beyond that. So we're in for a very long journey. Any other comments? Any other?
Actually, the couple things I was going to say, I can't top anything that you all are saying. Some of you, a lot of you on the phone know what I do, which is not direct clinical care anymore, but supporting a team of nurse practitioners and PAs that are in about 150 homes across the state of Florida and help out a couple of the medical directors in other states. So it's all peripheral, but it every day I hear stories like that. And I'm a person that wants to get visitation again and wants to have it safely. And then we got it, and I was concerned about the way it was done. But that's where our organization and the people on this call make a difference. You all and we collectively are the experts. And Diane, you've been a leader. I want to thank you personally and professionally. I see Diane's name mentioned, as it should be, even at the AMDA level, of how much work she's done to help bring awareness here. And the support from Ian and Shane, obviously, is important, and everybody on the call. The one thing I would say is, personally, is thank God, and a few of you on the phone have actually, several of you have met my wife. Thank God that I am married to somebody that I want to be around, because you hear about COVID divorces. We just had gotten a dog a few months before the pandemic, had no idea. And that has been a godsend, because I get to get out and walk her every day. And even when I don't want to, she's right there telling me, you're going to walk today. And then personally, I think it's important, and I think we have found, my wife and I, by reaching out to people to have Zoom calls, that a lot of the people we reach out to didn't know about the technology, weren't doing it, and now they're doing it with their families. I feel like we didn't start it. Somebody Zoomed us, and we said, this is a great idea. So it's almost a pay it forward type thing, where we have an average of about one every other week with somebody we try to, or a phone call if they can't Zoom. To stay in touch. My parents are still alive in Bradenton, where I grew up, and used to see them at least once a month. I've only seen them twice in 6 months, because I don't want to take a chance on bringing something to them, even though I'm in my own bubble. And, you know, they're both at high risk by age and by disease processes, even though they're not in a nursing home. So we are the leaders, and we have to keep that in mind, not just for this profession, but a lot of us in our families. I know myself, I'm the only physician. I'm the only one with that degree, an upper level degree in my family, above a master's level. So, you know, we're the leaders of the family, get them involved, and you never know when that's going to make a difference also, and help them so they get in touch with their families. You don't know who you're going to touch or help. So that's just my biggest takeaway from today. So, and thank you, Diane, Ian, and Shane. Thank you again for everything.
Well, I thank you both for sharing. It is a lot more sharing needs to happen. I know for anyone who's attending our conference in a few weeks, I think there's going to be opportunities to network. And if you're at another state conference, please network with other people and talk to them about what's happening. You know, I think those moments where we used to get together either in the facilities or, you know, even if you had the pleasure of rounding at a hospital and going into the doctor's lounge and talking, I think those moments are really missed. So, you know, whether it's via email, I love the Zoom ideas. I think I've taught a lot of people over the age of 75 how to use Zoom. You know, whatever we need to do, let's stay connected with each other.
I have one comment about that, Dr. Sanders, is I'm almost sort of secretly worried that this whole virtual thing is going to be the new normal all the time, even after the pandemic ends, because you can it's much more cost effective and you don't have to send people places. And I'm like, I really miss seeing people, and you're right, those little coffee chats where you learn something that might be better than any lecture you heard, you know, that morning. But so it's sort of, I think I'm very worried that all of a sudden it's going to be easier to just be this virtual reality now. And I'm like, I'm not sure that's going to help me professionally as much as I thought. I know it's a necessity right now, but it's you know, I just kind of worried where this is heading, because, you know, you don't have to worry about all the other stuff.
Well, I will say that I don't think, I think for societies like ours, this is not going to be the norm. We, whether it's AMDA or FAMDA or, you know, even AGS, no one wants to just be virtual. Mm-hmm. Because like you said, a lot, that networking piece is a big deal. I've met several people who are now mentors and who were bosses, Dr. James, Dr. Randall, like from coming to FAMDA's meeting, you know, so those networks are, that networking component, that is what we are always trying to duplicate in a virtual setting, and is never gonna be the same as in person. So I don't think that this is where we're going to stay at. I think there's a real desire to be with each other once we could do it safely.
Okay.
On that note,
thank you for helping me with that fear.
Yeah.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you for...
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.